BBC Five Live.
Time to say good morning to Fevzi Turkalp. Hello, Fevzi.
Morning, Callum.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. And of course, Fevzi's here as the Gadget Detective. It's the up all night tech and gadget phone-in. Give us a ring if you've got any questions for Fevzi. 08085 909693. And lots of texts coming in already on 85058. Fevzi, what sort of things are we going to be able to cover in the next little while on the programme?
Well, we've got a gadget of the week, which is something that might turn an iPad Pro into a laptop replacement. So that's a claim that Apple have been pushing for a while, but this device may make that a reality. Also, the latest announcements from Google as well, including a Babel fish.
Okay, let's do more on that in the next few minutes. I'm going to start with this from Dave, the Peterborough milkman, who's texted in. Morning, I have an iPhone 6. I've updated to iOS 11. And since doing this, my mobile banking app keeps crashing. I've tried reinstalling the app and still the same. Do you have any ideas for
Dave? So iOS 11 has brought a lot of new features. I would say it's more worthwhile for iPad users in terms of the benefits it brings at this point than for iPhone users. So my advice, first of all, for those who haven't updated their devices is probably just wait a bit. Now, in respect of particular apps, app makers are still updating their apps either to be iOS 11 compatible, or if they are compatible, to iron out the bugs. And every day I still see a couple of dozen apps updating on my devices that are iOS 11 related. So you might find that if you are patient, that it will come good. It's worth looking at the version history for that app and seeing if they have made changes which relate to being iOS 11 compatible. Have they made any changes at all recently? Some banking apps are a little bit behind the curve, but apps in general, they don't get a long time in advance to sort this out, because even if they're compliant with the various beta versions that come out before a launch, doesn't mean that they'll be stable with the final version. So I would say that it probably will be all right in the end, as long as they have done recent updates to the app. That means they will continue to do so. The other possibility in the meantime is to access those services via a browser. And by the way, there are arguably security benefits to doing that as well.
Thanks very much, Fevzi. Mike in St. Helens on an iPhone-related note. I'm selling this iPhone tomorrow. How do I clear its memory? And a good question, actually, because it's a big concern, isn't it? How much information do we have on our smartphones? And when we're getting rid of them, we need to make sure they're cleared properly, don't we?
Yeah, you do. And one of the important things to do before you actually do the step of wiping it down is to sign out of iCloud as well, which you can do via settings as well. So if you go to settings and then you on the top left, it will just say something like your name, and then it will say Apple ID, iCloud, iTunes. Make sure you're signed out of iCloud and iTunes on that device as well. Then it's a matter of clicking on General, then Reset, and then within that there's various reset options, but one of them will say something like Erase all content and settings, and that's the one that you want to go for. And at that point it will say, are you sure? And it will say, are you really sure?
Point of no return.
There's no way back from this. Yeah. So the other thing to say before doing any of that is, if you are buying another iOS device, or you think you may do, or you think you may need that data in the future, is to do a backup. And I'd say a local backup through iTunes on a desktop PC or an Apple device, and then in that way, let's say you get a new device, you can actually reinstate, in many cases, that backup. I've even managed to reinstate an iPhone backup to an iPad in the past. It's not perfect. Some of the settings don't come across, but the data does. It's not a recommended thing to do, but it's quite a good thing to do. So, backup. Sign out of iCloud and iTunes, and then go Settings, General, Reset, Erase all contents and settings, and Bob is your proverbial.
Great. And just on the point, on the issue of backing up, actually, a kind of related text from Carol in Cornwall, who says, without deliberately deleting them, my husband lost 2 WhatsApp messages on his Samsung Galaxy S6 phone. He doesn't have an SD card. This happened some weeks ago, but the messages were threatening, apparently, and he needs to retrieve them. So is there any way of getting those messages back from WhatsApp, which I believe does back up from time to time, doesn't it, WhatsApp conversations?
Yeah, the thing about WhatsApp messages is that they, I mean, not in all cases because it depends on the version, but in the case of the current versions, they are what's called end-to-end encrypted, such that even if the WhatsApp service provider, which is Facebook, were to have copies of it, they would only have encrypted copies of it, which is why Amber Rudd has been so vociferous on this topic, because the service is designed in such a way that third parties or indeed the service provider can't access the unencrypted version of the message. So the only question then is, you know, do you have a backup of that message yourself? Is it something that you have backed up? You could look into your, you know, trying to get it from WhatsApp, but my suggestion is that it would be rather difficult. I suppose if they had an encrypted version and they were willing to share it with you, then you could use your own password to unencrypt it, but I think the likelihood is that you won't recover those.
Yeah, I had a bit of a nightmare recently with WhatsApp, actually, because I'm convinced I have it set correctly to back everything up. And then my friend and I went through to try and find some hilarious conversation we'd had, you know, a couple of years ago, and it wasn't there. It just didn't exist anymore, and we were both absolutely heartbroken. But it's one of those things, isn't it? Backing up, I find, it can be quite confusing. It feels like sometimes you've got the settings set correctly,
yeah,
and yet actually some of your stuff seems to still disappear.
Yeah, and it's difficult with these sorts of proprietary apps because they don't necessarily sit in, you know, they're not necessarily a part of a main backup that one does on one's device. So, it's become more complicated. But what I would say is that people need to think about some sort of backup strategy. And the first stage in that is to recognize what data does your device hold, and moreover, which of that data would you want to be able to recover in the case of, you know, loss of the phone or damage to the phone or accidental deletion. And then think about how out of date you're willing for that data to be at the point of recovery. So if, for example, you're willing to lose a week's work or data, then obviously you can back up once a week. But if it's less than that, then you may want to back up daily. It's worth thinking about all of it. It's a bit like thinking about how you'd escape from your house in the case of a fire, and God forbid. But, you know, it's something that people arguably should do and think about what their escape route should be and so forth. In the same way, what can you do to back up? What would happen if that data died tomorrow, if your device died or was stolen? What would you do? Who would you contact? Do you even know what data you have? And it's similar to the problem of passwords as well. Like when we're told that our password has been breached on a particular website, do we then know even where else you've used that password? And hopefully we won't have used it anywhere else, but do you even know what other accounts that you have? When people have a data breach and someone, for example, is trying identity theft, and you have to go through every possible website, then do you even know where you're registered unless you use something like a password management tool? You know, you could spend a weekend just listing the sites that may be affected.
Yeah. Let's bring in Vincent in Hackney. Good morning, Vincent.
Everyone.
How are you doing?
I'm okay.
Good.
Okay.
And what would you like to ask Fevzi?
Yeah, I have no internet at home, no Wi-Fi or any fixed broadband, but I just use my phone, my mobile phone, as a Wi-Fi hotspot.
Yep.
And I use it to connect to my laptop. And for the past 2.5 years, I've been using it very, very, very happily.
Mm-hmm.
Any time of day, and it's very fast speed. And I can access banking, I can use YouTube, BBC iPlayer, and I can watch anything. I was very happy with it. But until the last 1.5 months, I've changed my price plan a wee bit.
Yep.
So therefore now, I don't know why, I can only use my Wi-Fi hotspot late at night, like this time of the morning. And sometimes it's very awkward to use it. And I don't know what else to do. I've been phoning up my phone company, and they've been going through the whole steps, and I've changed my SIM twice. And technically, nothing has changed. My phone is still the same. The laptop's still the same.
Mm.
And virtually, only difference is the price plan.
Yeah.
It's still unlimited data.
Yeah. Okay, Vincent. My suspicion is that they may be throttling your connection and may not have told you, it's worth checking the terms and conditions of this cheaper plan, because the cheaper the plan, the more likely they are to throttle. And so throttling means to choke back the speed that you're allowed. Yeah.
There may
even be that under the new price plan, they don't like tethering, which is precisely what you're doing, whereby you use data not just for use on the device, but to provide data to other devices acting as a Wi-Fi hotspot. That's known as tethering. And some plans don't allow it. Other plans allow it technically, but then throttle back. So I think it's worth investigating with them, because maybe the people you're speaking to don't realize that's happening, or maybe they're not being completely upfront with you about what's happening. It's specifically worth asking them, is there any throttling going on? Are the throttling criteria different under this plan than the earlier plan? Because it's very suspicious, because, as you say, it coincides completely with when you made the change. It's unlikely. Are you still seeing a 4G signal? Are you still seeing the same number of bars?
Yeah. The ironic thing is, right, this new price plan actually allows tethering, whilst the old price plan prohibited it. And I was happily using my laptop, but now they allow it.
Yeah.
Somehow I can't use the laptop during the daytime.
Yeah, but now that they allow it, maybe they're watching for it and the amount of it that one does. I mean, the other possibility is that it's not related directly to this change, but actually over time the amount of contention has increased, and that's to say the number of people in your area are seeking to access data. And again, that it could be the case, because what you may be seeing then is, you have to be up in the middle of the night, because then there are fewer people on it. So,
yeah.
Indeed, it could be some combination of those. Was it a very stark change, Vincent? Was it literally when the new system went live that suddenly you couldn't do it, or was it?
I can tell, like 5 years ago, I never had 4G and I had to use it later at night. But then 3 years ago, I had a 4G phone and I was using it any time of day. But now, until I've changed the price plan, it was like, it's a sudden drop. I was going back in time.
I understand. So the other thing that you can do to try and discern, which of those two options it is, or whether it could possibly be both, is to run speed tests on your actual device and then on a tethered device hanging off it. So you can go to a website, for example, there are various, but there's one called speedtest.net. It's a website, or you can get the app equivalent of it. They do the same thing. And you can run that on, what's your smartphone? Is it Android or iOS or something?
Mine is Android, HTC, and I'll do speed tests on the phone and the laptop.
And are they the same?
The laptop is considerably slower than the actual phone during the day.
Right. And is it a modern laptop?
That laptop is about 10 years old.
Okay. Have you got access to any other devices that you could use as a test to tether from there?
Yeah, I've got another phone.
Okay. So if the phone's relatively modern, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what you can do is you can tether that second phone from the first phone via Wi-Fi. That's to say, connect the second phone to the internet using the Wi-Fi generated by your first phone, okay? And run a speed test on each. If the tethered device remains considerably slower as it is for your laptop, that may suggest that the issue isn't with the internet speed coming in into your onto your first device, but rather something to do with the way that Wi-Fi is working, and then we can look at maybe configuration issues with the Wi-Fi. Because if you're getting fast on your primary phone but slow on the connected device, then you've sort of narrowed it down to be the Wi-Fi link between the two devices rather than the speed of the internet coming in. So I think that's an experiment worth doing, but I think it's also worth having done that basic experiment, is speaking again to your provider and asking them about any throttling, any caps.
Any speed restrictions.
Pardon me?
speed restriction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Throttling back. Yeah, that's just where they say, yeah, we're not going to cut your data off completely, but you're going to wish you weren't born when you try and use it, because they just squeeze it right down. And sometimes that tethering can be kind of a subtle curve. Other times it's just like a switch where they throw it. Sometimes it's just getting slower and slower. So even when you're trying to watch a movie via mobile data, you can actually find that you get worse and worse quality as it goes through. The picture becomes more pixelated even, because it's trying to struggle with less data to show the same movie.
Vincent, thank you very much. Thank you for your call. Thanks for getting in touch. The number 08085 909 693. Fevzi, I wonder if now, just before the news, is a good time to mention your gadget of the week. Just tell us a little bit about it. The Logitech Slim Combo.
Yeah, so this is an add-on device that you can buy if you're an iPad Pro user, and it comes in two versions. There's the version for the 10.5-inch iPad Pro and also for the 12.9. And Apple, when they released these devices, talked a lot about how they could become laptop replacements, you know, that people didn't need to have full-blown, you know, Windows laptops or even Macs, I would suggest, but that, you know, a lot of users, they could use this. And you know, to an extent, that's true. You know, you can do your email and your browsing, and in many ways, it's a better experience than even on a high-power laptop, because those devices are very powerful and very intuitive. But what they lack is a physical keyboard. And although you get a keyboard on the screen that you can type away on, first of all, there's no tactile movement or feedback from that. And secondly, about half the screen disappears because it's now covered by a keyboard. So the usable part of the screen is reduced. So what Logitech have produced, and they're a company that are well known for their accessories, is a keyboard and case combination. I understand it's developed in conjunction with Apple, and it's similar to Apple's own smart keyboard in some ways, but I'll contrast that in a minute. So it provides you with a laptop-like detachable keyboard. So there's a back that protects the back. The back has a kickstand on it, so you can vary it continuously to various degrees to have it almost flat or upright. So you get various viewing angles with it, even if you're not using the detachable keyboard. Or you just click the keyboard into position, and it locks with these three pin smart connector on the underneath, so it doesn't need to be Bluetooth paired. It actually uses a magnetic connector at the bottom. The keyboard, unlike the Apple version, is backlit, and it's a good quality keyboard. It's the same sort of quality as you would find on your average laptop, I think, as well. Unlike the Apple version of this, it's got an extra row of keys along the top, which are iOS shortcuts. They allow you to do things quickly that are specific to iOS. And again, it's surprising that Apple's own device doesn't have that. Plus, it's a small thing, but there's a loop to put the Apple Pencil on as well, because one of the things that Apple Pencil users find is that they lose it. Yeah, and it's £100. You know, it's not a good thing to lose. Interestingly, it has a number of differences and benefits over Apple's own device. First of all, it's about £50 cheaper than the smart keyboard, and the smart keyboard has no rear protection, so by the time you buy the rear protection as well separately, that costs you a lot more. And the Apple device has a fixed angle, because it has that sort of triangular fold behind it that just props up the device at a fixed angle, which may not be ideal. And as I say, it doesn't have backlighting on its keyboard either. It's got this sort of weird fabric-y keyboard. So it's a matter of taste, but I actually think Logitech in this example has produced a keyboard case combination which is superior and cheaper to Apple's own. So I've given it 4 stars out of 5.
Pretty good.
On the basis that it's more functional and cheaper. These are very personal choices as to what one likes, but what I can tell you is that the keyboard is a good size, the keys are well spaced, the backlighting works well. Try one out before you buy anything like that, or buy it online from a retailer with a very good returns policy, with a no quibble, I'll pick it up, or you can return it free of charge. Because consumer law was made worse a couple of years back, and your rights of return have been reduced somewhat. So it's worth finding retailers that actually have a better than the legal requirement minimum for returns.
That's good advice, actually. One of my friends was messaging over the last couple of weeks trying to find a product exactly like this, a case for the iPad with built-in keyboard, and I kid you not, he had about three delivered to him, and he returned all three of them
before he finally settled on one. I see it a bit like buying shoes online.
Yeah.
You end up buying several pairs, keeping one if you're lucky, and returning the rest. And as long as you know they've got a good returns policy, that's not a problem. And they know for these sorts of devices that people will... I mean, ideally, you could sort of go into a shop and try it, but shops stock less and less these days because they struggle to compete with the internet as well. Mm. So the ability to walk into a shop... Some Apple stores may provide it, but they tend to have their own devices on demonstration first and foremost, and you might have to go upstairs or to the back of the store to find the other merchandise.
Yeah, and actually, just as you've been speaking there, Martin's been in touch saying, I have the Logitech keyboard on my iPad Pro. I haven't used my laptop since. So there you go.
Yeah, it's not for everyone. I mean, if some of us need particular apps or particular functionality, which still, you know, bear in mind, we talked about iOS 11 earlier, so that's the operating system, like Windows or Mac OS. It's what runs on the Apple mobile devices. Only in iOS 11 for the first time has it provided you with any sort of filing system, the ability to save a file so that it can be opened by another app later. We used to have to go through all sorts of third-party solutions to try and do that, which is kind of fundamental, you know. And even now, the iOS 11's iteration is the first one that you know provides something approaching decent multitasking. Which again we all take for granted, I think, on laptops. So there's the iOS 11 Apple devices have got a long way to go on iOS, but iOS 11 is important because it's the first meaningful step into making these primary devices as opposed to adjuncts to, you know, your main laptop or desktop PC. And I think they've got a good future. You can kind of see how in the future you could have proper, you know, MacBook type devices running something based around iOS.
Yeah.
So that's arguably the future. Actually, there seems to be a lot more energy going into iOS than Mac OS, for example. Mm. So I think, you know, we will see a lot of the benefits, but the devices, they won't be as good for power users. You know, if you need to do really sort of clever or high end stuff, then, you know, a proper full operating system at this stage is still preferable.
And it's 2:39 on Up All Night, and this is Callum McDonald in the company of Fevzi Turkup, the gadget detective. Hello again, Fevzi.
Hello there.
And let's go straight to the phones. And if you'd like to get in touch, of course, 08085 909 693 is the number, or you can text your question to Fevzi on 85058. Peter is in Northumberland. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Hi there. And what would you like to get Fevzi to help you solve? What's your problem?
Right. I have an Epson printer on Windows 10, no matter how many copies I tell it to print, it will only do one.
Really? Regardless of what you regardless of what you put in?
Right.
No matter how many I set it for, it just does one.
And did this problem come about, Peter, as soon as you started using this particular printer with Windows 10? Or?
No, I think I've had it for a while. I've just got sick of it now. I've put up with it for quite a while.
So it's... but. Did it start with Windows 10, the problem, or did it occur?
No, I think it's been with a lot of my printers and 7 and XP.
Really? Okay. So how old is the printer, out of interest, the Epson?
It's about a year and a half.
Okay, so it's a modern printer, so it should have Windows 10 drivers in it. So you may find that it's worth taking a step back, and you'll know this, Peter, but I'll just do this for the benefit of others. Yep. So whenever you attach a device to a computer, it usually needs a piece of software that will describe that device and its capabilities and how it works to the operating system, because Windows 10, you know, we expect it to work with everything, but the reason why most devices can work is because there's this small piece of software that sits between, in this case, the printer and the operating system to say, I'm an Epson printer, this is my capabilities, this is how you access my capabilities. That's known as a printer driver. So there are printer drivers built into Windows 10 that are more generic and can work, but don't necessarily work fully or can have bugs in them. So the first thing to do is to make sure that you're running the latest version of the printer driver for your specific make and model and for your version of Windows as well, yeah, because it can
vary. Well, I've got a program that keeps the drivers up to date.
Right. I would go and do it manually because that program may have selected the wrong driver or may not have updated it. So it's worth going to the Epson website, going to the support section of the Epson website, and entering, you know, finding the section relating to your particular printer. And be careful, because there are a lot of similarly titled Epson printers that are different.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You go to that version and then you tell it you want to download the driver and which version of Windows that you're using, not just Windows 10, but which version of Windows 10 are you using. Yeah. So make sure you get the right one, because that last step in itself can cause a problem. So you get the latest version of the driver, and you make sure it's an Epson driver rather than a Microsoft Windows generic driver. That's the first thing. The second thing is, sometimes in addition to having the basic driver, there's an application, a software program built by Epson themselves that will make accessing the features easier, or even give you access to some clever features that aren't built into the driver itself. The problem could also lie there as well. So it's worth, if you have such a program, and Epson do such a program, if you have it, again, checking when you go to the Epson site that you've not only got the latest and appropriate version of the driver, but also of the printer program that should be there as well. Yeah, so that's the thing to do. Are there any other quirks arising when you use this printer, or everything else
works perfectly? No, that's the only thing. And it's not just this printer. It's with, I've got a few printers and it seems to be the same, but I've got a different Epson and that's the same.
So you're actually able to select the number of copies, but it will only produce one. Is that right?
Yes.
That's quite a bizarre bug, and particularly if it's happening across different printers, different makes as well.
I don't know. I've got another printer, but I don't really use it.
Okay. Well, look, I think we should try and solve the problem for the printer that you are using. Yes, it's interesting what you say, and it gives me pause for thought, frankly. But I think that the advice I've given you is certainly a good place to start. If none of that works, then I think it is a matter of, the printer's not very old. You would expect it to work with Windows 10. It's worth speaking to Epson support to see, whether they claim it's Windows 10 compliant, whether there's any known issues. And, in that regard, Google is your friend. You can look for, couch a search correctly, Epson printer name in quotations, and then say number of copies problem. Something like that will help you. And I hate to say, go and Google for it, but you'll do the basics. So the reason why I say you may end up Googling for it, because the support, and I don't single out Epson in this regard, but the support we get from companies is often lacking. Mm. And they can even give you incorrect information. It is worth seeking it, getting an undertaking from them that the device should be, Windows 10 compatible, but ask them, is this a known issue, and try and look on their website to see any evidence of other people suffering the same problem.
Peter, I hope that helps with the printer problem. Hopefully you're able to print off a few more copies at a time. That could be a bit of an annoying problem otherwise. That's Peter. Thanks very much for calling. Let's go straight to Alexandra in Birmingham. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I think it's a problem with your smartphone that you'd like to ask Betsy about.
Yes, it's an S7. And Samsung X7, and I started to have vertical lines on the right side of the screen, going from top to bottom. And it started off with a green, and then a pinky red, and then it went into a white with the green and pinky red either side of the white. And then this started to become wider and wider. And the white at one time covered half of the screen. But I've managed to get rid of that. But it left me with the vertical lines, green, white, and pinky red.
Right.
It's not ideal.
I understand. Okay. And that happens on, it doesn't matter what app is being shown or what's on the screen at the time, that same problem
happens. It doesn't matter what I have on the screen. It's there permanently.
Yeah. So unfortunately, this looks like a hardware problem. There aren't really software issues that could give rise to those symptoms, and particularly when you say it doesn't matter what I'm doing on the screen, so it's not like there's a fault with an app or unlikely that anything in the operating system would produce that unless it's been corrupted. Far more likely, unfortunately, that it's a hardware fault.
And when we say hardware, that means with the actual device.
I'm sorry.
Can you speak up a bit?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, Alexandra.
I have the infection, so I apologise for that.
No problem. I'll speak closer to the microphone. It's likely to be a problem with the machine, the device itself, rather than the software.
Yeah.
Was your handset, your phone, was it? Did it get wet or was it dropped or damaged
no,
in any
no,
way?
No. I've not dropped it. I've not put it in any moist areas, and it's been kept in a room temperature all the time.
I understand. And
because I'm on contract with it, and I've had it less than 6 months.
Okay. Well, there you go. So I was about to ask you how old it was and whether it might be under warranty. So the important thing is, and how long have you been having this issue with it, by the way?
Well, it suddenly started. I was scrolling down the screen.
How long?
It's a matter of how long?
About a week.
It's about a week.
Okay.
Two weeks.
So that's fine. So the likelihood it's covered. You need to go back to whoever sold you the phone. If it came as part of the contract, then your mobile phone service provider, and tell them that you believe that there's a fault with the phone. It should be under at least a 12-month warranty. And ask them to get it fixed for you. If they tell you to send it in and you're relying upon the phone, ask them if there's any possibility of getting a replacement handset sent out to you instead of a repair, or at least a loan handset. Some will do that, most will not, but it's worth asking the question. But it unfortunately does look like it's going to need a hardware repair. The good news is, you know, you've caught it hopefully within the warranty period. The important thing, and I'll say this to you, Alexandra, but also to others as well, report problems as soon as they occur, even if you're looking for solutions yourself, even if the problem is intermittent and hardly a nuisance, because the earlier you report a problem, even if it later becomes a problem and you need to send it back, the fact that you've put on record that it's been suffering with this problem from that date will make it much, much easier for you to get it dealt with, you know, potentially under a warranty. And particularly if it's coming up to a year and some, you know, you think, oh, I'm not sure if that's a fault or not, don't spend the time investigating. First report it, then investigate it. But you need to get in touch with your mobile phone provider and send it back to them, essentially.
Alexandra, hope that's helpful. Thank you very much for calling. Reminder of the number, 08085 909 693, or you can text 85058. Fevzi, a really, really good question from Neil here, actually, which may sort of be helpful to break it down, I suppose. But he says, as more and more of our daily lives go online and into the cloud, and in the recent light this week, actually, that the 2013 Yahoo account hacking tells us a whopping 3 billion accounts affected.
They thought it was only 1 billion,
yeah, only.
Callum. It turned out to be 40% of the population.
Isn't it incredible?
Planet.
Absolutely. Imagine that number of people having Yahoo accounts for a start.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I wonder how many of those Yahoo accounts are active, because actually, certainly the advice I've been giving people for a long time is that Yahoo, you know, in my opinion, wasn't necessarily the pinnacle of security.
Oh, really?
Well, they had quite high profile problems before this, and in fact Verizon, whose sale interestingly only completed in June of this year, so they purchased Yahoo, they actually cut the amount that they paid for it once this became known by about 300 million. And well, I'm not saying any more than that, but it's interesting that this further revelation has come to the fore after the sale is completed.
And the question, as a result of this concern around Yahoo particularly, or has brought it to light, what can we do online to best protect ourselves from these attacks and to keep our personal information secure? What are some top tips, do you reckon, Fevzi?
Neil, if I may say, that is an excellent question. That's probably the I may be corrected on this, but so far that's the question of the night. You get the gong. So the basic advice is, do not use the same password on different websites. So when you go, so most of us use at least 10, 20, 30 different websites, some of us a lot more. And often in order to be able to use that website, you have to provide them with your email address as a minimum and create a password. And many of us use the same passwords from site to site to site, or we think we're being clever, we use a simple derivation of it. Now, neither of those are acceptable. And the reason for it is this. If, or should I say when, that website gets hacked, they're going to have potentially your email address and password. Depends on how well that's been scrambled by the website providers. Often we find that it hasn't been scrambled at all. It's been stored in what they call in the clear. So now, if that's done, first, it doesn't just mean that anything that you were doing with your account may have been put at risk. But if you've used the same combination of email address and password elsewhere, they don't need to know that you've got an Amazon account or bank with a particular bank or building society or credit card. They will try that combination of data and derivations of the passwords, by the way, automatically within minutes. They can run that data across the 99% of the most popular websites, and if you use that combination or derivation thereof elsewhere, then they'll crack those open. So although the website that might get hacked is, I don't know, a knitting club website, if you've used the same details on your banking, then you're in trouble. Now, why do people use the same combination? They use the same password because it's hard to remember.
Exactly.
So, and our lives become hell because we're told, particularly by banks, don't write it down.
Which
don't
I think
share it with anybody.
So many people are guilty of having a note on your phone just with a list of passwords.
Yeah, or putting it in the sleeve of your phone because you use it for banking via an app. Don't do any of those things because, the fraud guarantee that's provided by banks has been watered down over the years with the advent of online banking. It used to be the case that if someone stole your checkbook and or committed an act of fraud against you in the days of manual accounts, that you were covered without question. Now that they ask you, did you do enough to protect it? So that could even
That's
be did you have up to date antivirus software on your device? And a lot of us don't have it on our
Absolutely.
Mobile devices. So, and they will look for ways, so don't give them an excuse. So the best way, look, there is no perfect solution to this, but the solution that I advocate is to use a piece of software called password management software. There are many of those. Good ones that I could suggest to you are LastPass, all one word, LastPass, or 1Password, numeric 1, followed by the word password, or one word. Now, what password management software does is a couple of things. First of all, each time you go to a new website and you need to generate a password, it will generate one for you that is secure. And that's to say, it's gobbledygook. Don't worry, because you don't need to remember it, but it's just, all you do is you tell it, for example, it needs to be 20 characters, 25 characters, 30 characters, however many characters, needs to include at least one numeric, digit, or it can or cannot use special characters like hash or comma or whatever. You give it the parameters, because those parameters vary from site to site, so you don't want it just to have free reign. But you set those parameters for the site, it goes off and gives you a password, which is different from all your other passwords, but also something that isn't guessable, because it's not something that you're ever going to have to remember. So it creates those for each website that you create an account on. It then stores those in a encrypted software vault, that's to say, a software area on your device that itself is then protected. And how is it protected? Well, ironically, it's protected with a password. But so two things to say about that. Make that password very secure, don't write it down, and that is one you do have to remember, okay? But set up what's called two-factor or multi-factor authentication. That's to say, to open that vault, which you only have to do once in that sort of browsing session or even that day perhaps, set it up so that you not only have to enter the password, but you have to have something else. You have to own something else. So, for example, that could be a fingerprint. If your phone has a fingerprint reader, it could be that they send a text to your mobile phone with a code that you then have to enter. So even if someone got the keys to the kingdom, the master password of your vault of passwords, they still can't get in because they don't have the second factor, you know, unless they've stolen your phone or, dare I say, your finger. Yeah. They can't get in. So once you've done that, there are a number of benefits. First of all, it means you can unlock the vault in the morning and surf as if it was 1989. Where you didn't have to worry about security because it's auto-filling your passwords as you go. And the other benefit is, if you do get one of your websites that you use gets hacked and you find out, then you've already got a list of all the websites that you use and all the passwords. And it's very much easier if you did feel it was necessary to go in and change everything. Then you can do it, or you can just do it annually or monthly or six monthly, whatever you want to do. It's all there. It makes it manageable. And it's called password management software. It's not a perfect solution because, as I say, all the passwords are then, protected in one basket. But given what we see happening with, barely a day going by with the websites not admitting to being hacked, it's the lesser of several evils in my opinion, and it's the way that I would go. The only other thing that I would say is, so we've talked about the passwords, it's worth also realizing that you do have options for creating unique email addresses as well, and you could set up a different email as well if you were quite fastidious about this. So for example, if you registered your own name, like, I know, CallumMcDonald.com, mm-hmm. you register the domain name if you have a website, or you're willing to pay £10 a month for a domain name, then you can set up an infinite number of email addresses which are something at CallumMcDonald.com. Okay. Yeah. So that could be NatWest@CallumMcDonald.com, which is only used at NatWest. Now, why would you do that? Partly because it's even more secure, because then they have that email address won't be used anywhere else. But it's also a canary. And what do I mean by that? We hear a lot about websites being hacked, but I can assure you there are a lot more websites that get hacked than we hear about. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the way that you find out is if you start getting, let's say I've set up, xyzbank@CallumMcDonald.com because I've registered an account with that bank. And then I start getting strange spam email sent to xyz@CallumMcDonald.com. That's a pretty good indication that they've been hacked. And I'm not going to name them here, but there are many, many big companies who I have accounts with who have been hacked because I know, because I'm getting spam email from them, that haven't told me that they've been hacked, or as far as I'm aware, anyone else. So first of all, you can tell when one of your services has been hacked, or one of the services that you use has been hacked, and you can switch off that email so you don't get plagued with spam for the rest of your life. Yeah, because it was only xyzbank@CallumMcDonald, not all the other variants. So that's a good thing to do as well.
Good tips, Fevzi. And probably one of the biggest sort of challenges, personal security of our time, isn't it? Trying to keep all of our online data secure. So
it is.
Yeah, locking it down is. Those passwords, very helpful.
Just with the password manager, the nice thing is it actually makes using the internet fun again. Because you don't have to stumble over every single website that you go to, trying
Absolutely.
To say, oh, I can't remember it. And you end up having to reset the password every time you need to get to that site, because maybe you only visit it once every few months.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should hastily delete the note on my phone that has several, not all of my passwords, but several passwords in it as well.
Yes, and take the post-its off your screen as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for your company. And we're back with Fevzi Turkup, the gadget detective. Hello again, Fevzi.
Hi, Callum. Can I just say one thing?
Yeah,
it's been
of course.
Pointed out to me that there was one thing missing from that review I gave of that Logitech keyboard.
Okay.
I didn't actually say what it was called. Sorry.
That's all right, carry
rookie,
on.
Rookie error. It's called the Logitech Slim Combo.
Great. Yeah? There
so
we go.
There we are.
Good. Available
not to be confused with the Connect, which is an older generation.
Available from all the usual electronic and gadget retailers, I'm sure. So yes, Fevz is here from the website gadgetdetective.com, and lots of questions coming in on text 85058, or you can call us as well, 08085 909693, and you've got until 3:30 to get your question to Fevzy this morning. Right, let's do a couple of texts then, Fevzy. This one's come in, no name on this one. Hi guys, is it worth waiting for the new Echo devices, or should I buy the current version, hopefully with a good discount? We should probably explain what an Echo device is, first of all, Fevzy.
Yeah. If you'd have given me some warning, I would have switched my Echo on. But,
well, we can come back to it if you can multitask.
It's fine. She may wake up during the course of this answer.
Do you want me to shout Hello Alexa at it? Will that work?
No, because I've got closed back headphones on. Okay. So it's not going to work.
Fair enough.
But Echo devices are devices produced at the moment by Amazon. It's Echo is their brand and their creation, and these devices within these devices live an artificial intelligence being known as Alexa. So it's like Siri for Apple Kit. Apple have Siri, Amazon have got Alexa, and it's a very useful device in that it's got a speech interface, no keyboard. The current versions, and this is changing now, but the current versions, you have no screen, so you speak to it speaks back to you, and there's a lot of things that you can ask it. So you can ask it about, you know, the weather or the traffic situation. You can add things to your to-do list. You can even buy things. There was a case recently of a parrot managing to buy gift boxes from Amazon by parroting what its owners said. So these are nice devices. Mm. They are quite clever. There's a number of uses for them that people may not realize, that if people are users of ebooks, if they buy Kindle ebooks, then there's a very good, and I think the best in the industry, text-to-speech conversion built into Alexa. So if you tell it to read your ebook, it will read the text from your ebook that you might otherwise see on an ebook reader or a smartphone or tablet. It will read it to you in a very nice, almost human voice. That, you know, the days of really bad, yes, stilted voices, they are going now. So it's quite a good thing. It will also do, hold on one second, I'm just looking for the cable.
No, that's, do you know, right, what? Carry
I'm so, on. I'm so sorry. It will also read Audible books as well. So Audible is a company owned by Amazon, which do talking books. And it will read those to you as well. So the talking books are rather nice, but the fact that it will do ebooks, that's great, because when you buy things, if you're an Amazon Prime customer and you buy something, you say, you know what, I don't need it now. Mm. I'll accept what's called a no rush delivery. They will not at the moment, but usually they will be giving you a £1 voucher that you can put towards ebooks or MP3s and so forth. Also, you can use it to play music as well. So you can ask it to select types of music and so forth, and it will know what you like to listen to. It will suggest music for you, or it will allow you to play music by a certain artist. Or you can even say, play me that song that goes Goo 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 by M. The Walrus or something like that. And it will work out what it is and play it for you.
Whoa.
So it's really quite, I have to say, it's really quite clever. Yeah, I do like it. So
how are you getting on? Have you managed to find the keyboard?
No, do you know what? Do you know what? I'm just going to plug this
in. Yeah, go for it.
Manually here.
And this is an Alexa. What device is this?
This is the original Echo. So this is the one that looks like a kitchen, half-used kitchen roll on its end.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's at the moment, as we speak, there is the Echo, which is a full-size device,
yeah,
and then there is the Echo Dot, which is a much shorter device that doesn't have the same quality of speaker into it. Mm-hmm. In it. But what it can do is, that's not a problem if you're using it to listen to ebooks. If you're listening to music, what you want to do is connect an external speaker, either in some devices, either with a wire or via Bluetooth as well. Well, look, I can see lights going on this thing, so
okay,
it's
going to
woke. It's going to. There we go. It's
oh my goodness, up. It's dramatic.
There we go.
Hello.
Oh, bless. Let me see. Alexa, tell me a political joke. It's safe, don't worry.
Okay.
Why did Karl Marx dislike Earl Grey? Because all property is theft.
I thank you. I can't resist that joke. I don't know. Alexa, sing me a song.
Here's a real classic. Should old
Alexa, stop that. No. Now, let me see. Alexa, what's the weather like in London? Alexa, what's the weather like?
In London, it's 12 degrees with clear skies. Today, you can expect partly sunny weather, with a high of 14 degrees and a low of 8 degrees.
There you go.
There you go. Alexa, comprehensive.
Alexa, read me a book.
Getting your book from Audible. Resuming, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, Treasury. There's 14 minutes left in the chapter.
Good, it's BBC.
And 18 hours, 23 minutes left in the book.
Wow.
What a carry-on.
Alexa, stop. Alexa, read Kindle book.
Resuming your most recently added book from Kindle. Here's Mindset, How Positive Thinking Will Set You Free and Help You Achieve Massive Success in Life. Mindset.
So
mindset,
it does techniques, a huge range of
positive
things.
Mindset.
Just listen
success
to the voice.
Mindset, Self-Help, Motivation by Benjamin Smith.
This is a preamble.
Want to hear an audiobook performed by a professional?
There's an advert
actor
for it, but when we get past that, I would like you to hear the text-to-speech because I think it's best in class.
Okay.
Chapter 1, Why the Need to Embrace Positive Thinking. Before discussing how exactly to develop a positive mindset, it is essential to discuss its amazing benefits.
Alexa, stop. And that was a free ebook as well. So, so I think that that's pretty good.
I'm a bit worried. If a machine can read out words so well,
yeah,
I'm not sure what the future is here.
It doesn't, yes. Well, it doesn't need a rocket scientist to work out how that's going. By the way, the engineer's job is under threat as well. Now, having played for some time, to answer the question,
yes,
is it worth going for the new versions? I would say yes, because most of them are imminent in that they're available. Some of them I think the 25th of this month, the earliest ones. So there's various versions. The new version of the Echo is cheaper than this one for a start. So you ask about the discount. Yes, you'll get a discount, but it will only really bring it down to a similar price level as the new one. Yeah, and it has a couple of benefits. It has so you know we have Internet of Things. That's to say, all these smart devices that can be controlled by a computer. Well, now it could be a light bulb. So you've got a Philips Hue light bulb. At the moment, you need to buy a sort of bridging device, which is more expenditure. Now the bridge is built into the new Echo, and it comes at the moment with a free Philips Hue light bulb, and that means you can control your lighting or whatever else that you attach via that hub, via voice. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, Alexa, dim the lights.
Yeah.
All of this. All
that's what I was actually playing with these in a shop today.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're really, really cool. And all the kind of smart devices, actually, just the way that you can kind of automate everything and, you know, it's amazing. I love it.
So the Echo is the full size Echo is worth having because it has that. There's a cut down version which is cheaper, which doesn't have that. It's a little bit shorter, but still good quality. But probably more interesting to me at the moment is the Echo Show, which you can also pre-order. The Echo Show has a 7-inch color screen on it.
Okay.
So it's not a touch screen. You still have to access it using your voice. But for example, when it reads you the weather forecast, it will show it to you. When it plays a song on, from its music collection, it will show the lyrics on the screen. Or you can get to YouTube videos now, and you can connect it to cameras as well around your home. So, for example, if you've got a nursery, you can say, Alexa, show me the nursery. And it will. It will route to that camera and it will show you on its screen what's going on. That's a great device. They're not cheap. They're about, I think, $199 for one or $299 for two. So they're not cheap, but they are rather good.
Okay.
There are a couple of other interesting devices. There's one device that they've announced, which is it connects to your home phone and allows you to dial numbers by voice from your home phone in the similar way that, for example, Siri can do it for your for your iPhone. Mm-hmm. It brings that functionality to the home phone. So having given you the long answer, the short answer is yes, I would wait.
It's good though. I love the demonstration there. It was great because I've never seen or used an Alexa speaker in person. I'm sure a lot of people listening haven't either. So that's very helpful in kind of conveying how effective it can be.
Yeah, and I actually find it interesting because even though Siri has been improved in iOS 11, and by the way, don't go for iOS 11 yet unless you're a technology journalist and need to, because it's still quite buggy.
Yeah.
But even though they've improved the voice of Siri, it is not as good as what you've just heard. What you've just heard, it reading text files, in a human type voice. Yes, it's not perfect, but it doesn't.
Pretty impressive.
Great. It doesn't. You can listen to ebooks on it quite comfortably, and it brings them to life. And also for people with visual impairment, not only for that, but for people with visual impairment, instead of having to rely on a somewhat limited stock of audiobooks, you know, and waiting for the latest titles to come out and all the rest of it, you can now access those books in a very usable fashion without any additional cost. And some ebooks are a rip-off, but some of them are even free. You know, that the book I was reading from then, that was free. I picked it up, I downloaded it, and I must admit I haven't listened to it yet, but hopefully my life will be turned around and I won't even have to read the book.
There you go. Just on the live demonstration point, text from David who says, I'm listening to you on Echo, and every time you say hello to it, his device starts asking him what he wants. And Alad's had a problem where every time you're saying Alexa stop, apparently it was halting his listening of Radio 5.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I should replace the word with shlomo or something, you know, and shlomo, don't do it. Yeah, no, it is a problem because, in fact, there was a radio broadcast that caused the purchase of a number of items around the country.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Also, there was a case in America where an Amazon Echo box became a witness in a murder trial.
Really?
Yes, because a man, unfortunately, it's a sad story, obviously it's a murder, but he was murdered in his hot tub and there was an Amazon Echo unit, you know, beside it, which is a good use for that because, you know, you don't have to touch with wet hands the device. You can choose your music and so forth. The man was murdered and the police subpoenaed Amazon to produce what recordings, because the way these devices work is they're not very smart in and of themselves. They've got 7 microphones built into them so you can speak to them even from across the room. They take effectively a recording of your speech, any speech that follows that keyword, which I now won't mention again. and then it sends that off to Amazon's servers, their computers. They crunch that, work out what has been said, work out what the reply should be, and send the reply back for it to voice. So actually, the device is fairly dumb. But what that means is that these recordings were being sent off, and the police wanted to know, because perhaps there was something said. You know, they would be fairly lucky to get it because it would have to be preceded by the trigger word. Interestingly enough, the really good evidence came from another device. It came from the water meter, because the guy washed down, it's a bit gruesome this, but he washed down the blood, and he used a lot of water doing it. He or she used a lot of water doing it, and they were able to tell at what time the murder took place because they knew that all that water had been consumed directly after the murder.
Wow.
So our automated devices not only spy on us, but may be useful witnesses if we are ever the victims of crime.
Absolutely. How fascinating. It's 3:20, so we've got about 10 minutes left with Fevzi. And Jack in Brighton has called in. Hello, Jack.
Hello there.
Hello. And I think you've got a question around sharing large files for Fevzi.
Yeah, yeah. Hello, Fevzi.
Hi there.
Yeah, I need to share some large files with some various people, and I wonder what the best way to do it was, rather than sending large attachments on an email.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously, I know about Google Docs from years ago, but I haven't really used it in recent years. So I just wonder if there's any other ways or, you know, things to do or whatever.
There are, So I'm sorry, I cut you short. I apologize for that. So you're right. When you attach a file, be it a photo or, you know, something else to an email, Even if your email program allows you to send it, there's always some uncertainty about what the limitation of the recipient's email is and what it can receive. So you end up having to say, please, can you email me back just to let me know you've got this and all that nonsense. So Google Docs can be used, but that's normally used for collaboration where more than one person is working on a document of some sort, and you know, you want a team accessing and seeing updated versions. Probably a better solution would either be to create a Dropbox account. And there are free accounts. So what you do there is you upload it to the Dropbox service, and then it creates a link. You then email the link, and they click on the link and download it from there. Yeah. So the file the file itself doesn't get emailed. Only the much smaller link gets emailed. Another very similar service, sometimes when people send me audio of radio stuff that I've done, they send me via a service called WeTransfer, or one word. And I think the nice thing about that is I think you can even use that without creating an account. With Dropbox, you get free accounts, and then if you want more space, you get paid for account. I think it might be similar with WeTransfer, but I think there is even a way of trying that out without having to set up the account first. If you do set up an account, remember what we said about passwords, and you know, make them unique. And also the other thing to say is just be aware that, you know, if the content of those files is in any way sensitive, then you're putting it on even more servers than you would be arguably by emailing it. One last tip, and I'll just share this with you sort of for completeness. If you have a number of photos to send, but you want to email them and they're too big because they're, let's say, 3 or 4 megabytes each, then you can use as a free photo program called Irfan View, IRF for Freddie, AN for November, Irfan View, all one word. That has got a batch compress option. So you can, let's say, put, if all your pictures are in one folder on your computer, you can direct it towards that folder and say, everything in that folder or these files one after the other, compress them by this amount, you know, so you can say 35%, 50%, 70%, the higher the percentage, the less compressed they are. And you can experiment with that. And then you can, there's a very clever thing because it's doing it in batch, all automated. You can say, add the word compress to the file name, or add the letter C to the file name. So it will produce and store them in this folder, so you can store them somewhere else. So you could say, even if you had 20 images that you needed to send on a single email, if you compress them sufficiently, you can send them all in one email. And what I often do is I often will do that and then say to them, if you need anything else in higher resolution, let me know. I've got the uncompressed original. And that's quite a nice way of doing it, because the problem is, if you want to compress it manually, it's a problem. If you want to let Outlook compress it, it will only compress it if there are not too many of them in the first place. So something like Irfan View is good for what's called batch compression or batch processing of images.
So Dropbox, I mean, is Dropbox similar to Google Docs? Because I can create links on Google Docs, I think, as well. Is that the same sort of thing?
It is similar. I think there's a...
Is it just better than Dropbox for that sort of thing?
I think, well, Dropbox is designed for that use, yeah. Google Docs, it can be put to that use, but it's not its primary function. As I say, the primary function of Dropbox is for collaboration.
Right. So I also wondered what you thought of the Yahoo announcement in recent days, or something about their hacking thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's. Have you got any?
Well. Okay, what can I tell you? carefully. I haven't used Yahoo email for many years, and there have been some who felt that their security hasn't been at the pinnacle of what was possible, technologically speaking. It's difficult because this latest announcement is essentially old, because this hack took place I think it was in 2013, and there was another hack prior to that as well. So I personally wouldn't advise people to have an email with them now.
Because I've got Yahoo email through BT, and they changed their passwords a few years back. But obviously Yahoo have made some other announcement in the last few days that the scale of the hack has been much bigger, I think, or something.
I mean... Look, there are different views on this. I mean, for example, Google's Gmail has got one of the best spam filters in the industry. Yeah. On the other hand, people don't like the fact that Google scan emails for keywords and provide advertising and target advertising in that way. So, you know, you may email someone saying, I'm thinking of going on holiday, and suddenly you start seeing adverts for holidays. It's a little bit, to me, that's a little bit creepy. I don't want their bots scanning over my email. So, you know, you may say, I don't want Gmail, Yahoo, as far as I'm aware, don't do that. But I just think that, you see, the difficulty is a lot of people have Yahoo legacy emails. They've always had one. They don't want to change it because it's been set up. I would personally look at setting up another email account. I would consider doing what we discussed before, which is to register a domain name. So, you know, as we said before, you know, callummcdonald.com. I don't know. Have you got that one?
I actually do, yes.
Callum, what's your website? what's your website?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about it, but it has been talked about an awful lot in the last half hour or so. And thank you very much for that, Fevzy. I'll be looking at Google Analytics first thing in the morning.
Anyway, well, I didn't actually know you had that at the time. I was going to go and register it quickly, but it's gone. If you have your own domain name, that's to say, you know, I don't know, fevzyturkout.com, which isn't a website, but I do own, so don't bother. So if you have that, then you can set up your own email. So, you know, you could have fevzy@fevzyturkout.com, for example. And then the nice thing about that is you can still use an underlying email address like Yahoo or Gmail or whatever, and just direct. So what happens is that you publish fevzy@fevzyturkout.com, and it will then forward to, let's say, your Gmail account. So Gmail is doing all the legwork. But what it means is if one day you become unhappy with Gmail or Yahoo or whoever it is, you can change the underlying email account without you having to republish your email address all the time, every time you change provider, because the only one that you're publishing is the one relating to the domain name that you've done. So I don't know if that makes sense, but if you are thinking of changing email address, consider getting your own domain name, and then that will hopefully be the last change you need to make, because you can change the underlying provider without having to send out a new email address to everybody.
Good idea. Jack, thank you very much. That's Jack in Brighton. Thanks for calling. And we've got a couple of minutes left, Fevzy, so I'll put a couple of text messages to you if that's all right.
Sure.
A couple of very quick ones here, hopefully. Is there a charge if I use WhatsApp voice call to a landline, or is it free? Are you even able to do that? Can you use WhatsApp to call a landline?
To be honest, I don't know the answer to that I'll be perfectly honest, because of their privacy policy, I refuse to use their services. Mm. So I actually don't know the answer to that, and I apologize. I will find
That's
out.
All right.
If can I just say, and as we're doing plugs, if you want to have that question answered, please get me on Twitter @GadgetDetective. And for anyone who is, we're coming up to the end of time now, anyone who didn't get their question to air, because I know it's been busy, if you tweet me, I will do my best to answer you. So you don't even have to follow me if you don't want to, but it's @GadgetDetective, and that's a good way to get your questions answered as well.
Great. On that one, I'm not sure if you would be able to use WhatsApp to call a landline. I feel like it's possibly just from WhatsApp to WhatsApp account, if that makes sense.
Yes, which would be free, but yeah.
Of course, but may use data if you're not connected to Wi-Fi.
Good point, yes.
And just a final one, given it's kind of been the theme of the night. William asks, hello, how do you rate Apple Keychain for password security? Which I think is kind of Apple's version of what you were describing just before 3 o'clock, Fevzy.
Apple have got... See, with security, it's very difficult because almost by definition, you don't know exactly how it works unless it's, you know, open source code where the code is actually published. I tend to trust Apple more than I trust other providers because they make their money out of selling you expensive devices, not by monetizing your data. So that's the difference in the business model between Google's Android and Apple's iOS. I think it's okay. I think I still quite... And the integration with their devices, obviously, is very convenient. I would personally look at some third-party solutions as well. Apple have probably published what's called a white paper on their keychain technology. That's to say, it's sort of a technical document that tells you about it. In general terms, I trust Apple more, but I don't trust anyone completely. In fact, there's a strand of security tech called TNO, Trust No One.
What a positive message.
I think, well, it's unfortunately, this is the world we live in, isn't it? It's a rather dark message, I guess. But yeah, so not bad, but there are probably third-party solutions that will do an even better job.
Great.
Because that's their raison d'être.
Perfect. Fevzi, thank you so much for all your time tonight and for answering so many questions. That's Fevzi Turkalp, the gadget detective. You can find him on Twitter. You can find his website if you have other questions that need answered as well.
BBC Five Live.